Sleep felt productive. Something was getting sorted out. I knew in my heart, this was perhaps the only thing my heart knew back then, that when I'd slept enough, I'd be okay. I'd be renewed, reborn. I would be a whole new person. Every one of my cells regenerated enough times that the old cells were just distant, foggy memories. My past life would be but a dream, and I could start over without regrets, bolstered by the bliss and serenity that I would have accumulated in my year of rest and relaxation. Narrator, my year of rest and relaxation. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Weibel.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, the podcast where we discuss modern literary classics, books that had a substantial impact on the zeitgeist when they came out and that continue to endure. Our last two episodes were on The Secret History by Donna Tartt and Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk. And I want to thank all of the people who wrote to us to share their thoughts on those two books. You had some great takes and interesting comments. So thank you both for listening and for taking the time to engage with us. We appreciate that. And keep it coming. You can write us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Instagram, also at Reading Pop Classics. And if you're on Lit Salon, we are on there as well under Reading Pop Classics. So today we are discussing Otessa Moshfegh's My Year of Rest and Relaxation. This is her second book that came out, second or third? Do you remember which? I don't.
I want to say it's her third.
Eileen definitely came out first, and this was either her second or third book that came out. Popular pretty much as soon as it came out. Killer cover, which I think goes a long way. Jane Austen inspired, I would say, with the disappointed looking lady on the front and the hot pink title letters. So Rebecca, I will start you off with a question. Do you think this book is satire?
Yeah, 100%.
Do you? I listened to an interview with Otessa Moshfegh where someone said that. She was like, I don't think it's satire. I think the character, our main character, has a satiric point of view, but that the book itself is not satire. And I think I am on your side. I think I disagree with the author of this book. The Dr. Tuttle parts alone, I think, put it over into satire.
That's what I was going to say. For me, what stood out, maybe the overall point of the book or message behind the book from her perspective, from Otessa's perspective, is that it's not meant to be satirical. But the narrator herself is very over the top. I find that there are certain scenes and things with her parents that I find to be also just kind of like cartoonish and over the top. Certainly Dr. Tuttle, to your point, and even Reva. Reva, yeah. I actually find to be a little bit, maybe the most, the least satirical. I actually, like, having lived in New York in my 20s, I know Reva. I know Reva real well. She's maybe the most on the nose for me, but even then, she also has these kind of over the top moments that lead me, that is what makes me feel like this book is incredibly satirical.
So it's interesting you say that, because I also spent my 20s in New York, and this is a very accurate, in some ways, portrayal of that very specific life experience.
Yes.
And I sort of wondered, when I was doing getting prepping for the one stars, some of the people who like hated this book, and there were a variety of reasons, some of them very well argued, but it does seem awfully specific. And if you, I don't know, spent your life in Missouri, does the sort of nightlife, striving, messy existence of being 24 in the Upper East Side, out in Brooklyn, down in Chelsea, like, does that translate? Because the book doesn't like take pains to necessarily explain the setting, besides the fact that it's 2000, like, besides the very heavily foreshadowed, like, it's almost 2001. It doesn't quite say that, but like, besides really letting us know that 9/11 is coming, the book doesn't it doesn't interrogate that city and that age range heavily, I don't think.
That's an interesting question, because I actually often, I often think along those lines when I'm reading. I mean, just so many things take place in New York. So many books take place in New York. And sometimes I'm reading a book that takes place in New York, and some of New York lifestyle, being a certain, being there in a certain time and a place, being a certain age, being in a certain business or field or line of work or whatever it is kind of explained.
Yeah.
It's like the author understands that, like, not everybody moved to Manhattan right after college and lived there for 10 years or whatever. And so, you know, and sometimes it's not. And it's a really good point that this book just kind of drops you into it.
Well, and so many New York books do the sort of like fantasy of New York, where like you've got you either have the hotshot job that like is the dream job, and that's the fairy tale aspect of living there at the, you know, height of some sort of career trajectory is the point of the story. Or, you know, it's the sort of dirtbag, like gutter existence. Like, I don't know, I can't think of a good example right now, but I'm sure there's people just slumming around New York, drinking and doing drugs. And like, that's the point of the book. Name one. There has to be one. Why can't I think of one?
Bright Lights, Big City. That's
sure.
We're sort of, right? Yeah, a little bit. I mean,
yeah,
they have jobs that pay them a lot, I guess. But I mean, that's not the point. That's not the point of the book.
No, Bright Lights, Big City, or I would even say American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis while those books have like the point of view they're getting at overall, they certainly indulge in like the fantasy life of New York, of just like rich, powerful people bopping around at clubs, and like that sort of setting explains itself. This book doesn't do that, which is an interesting take on it. And it's sort of the anti-book of that, right? Like that's sort of, it feels like the point is to specifically not be the book that glamorizes New York or that glamorizes living in New York.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does seem like that's part of its charm.
I think part of its charm, specifically, maybe if you did live in New York.
But she does live a little bit of a charmed New York life. I mean, she owns her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
She owns an apartment on the Upper East Side, in a doorman building. She doesn't own, you know, she doesn't own an apartment in like a walk up.
No, she does. I mean,
do you know, like, she doesn't own an apartment in like a walk up in a building that isn't that nice, you know?
I think you're touching on one of the central tensions of the book, which is that a charmed life? Because how did she get the apartment?
Fair.
Because her parents died and she inherited their insurance policies and their money. And that's sort of what the book wrestles with a little bit.
There is a tension between this girl. Her looks are talked about a lot. She talks about her looks a lot. Other people talk about her looks. She's thin, beautiful, and rich.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, from an outside perspective, this is not my perspective, she's thin and beautiful and rich, which is what everybody wants and a reason to be happy, right? Again, this is an outside perspective. This is not my personal perspective.
We wouldn't refer to it as a privilege if it wasn't. It is considered a very privileged position.
It's a privileged position, but she comes from these self-described like cold, emotionless people.
Well, she looks, I mean, her mother was a beauty queen who is described, there's a comment within the book where she mentions that her mother never cooked or cleaned, and that though it could be considered like an act of feminism, it was really just because it would make her feel more like a failed beauty queen.
Yeah.
So like her looks come from a depressive point of failure on her mother's part, like kind of handed down to her. Her money comes from her parents' death.
Being pretty is all her mom ever was.
Yeah.
Right. Her mom has literally accomplished or done nothing else. She doesn't even see her own beautiful daughter as an accomplishment, apparently.
No.
She doesn't. Her dad's not some like warm, effusive guy who makes up for that. They don't have, you know, he's very buried in like his work. He's in an unhappy marriage, and it doesn't seem like he has a whole lot to do with this kid.
No, I mean, she's got the two. It's sort of an inversion of a cliche or a stereotypical thing where like mom is very, very attractive, but she's like depressed, and like the there's a toxic piece of that that like she inherits those, she inherits the looks and the beauty, but from this person who is unfulfilled by them and is just sad about it. Her dad's smart, the moneymaker, and she's an intelligent person. She goes to Columbia. She inherits intelligence, but like it comes from this sort of like, I don't know, weak-willed shadow of a man, right?
Yeah.
Like she gets these great traits that like just come from poisonous places, from poisonous people.
Right. So it's like, again, you know, from this outside perspective, thin, beautiful, rich. She's smart.
And the money comes from a tainted well also.
She's smart. She's come, you know, she's gone to an Ivy League school. She has a lot going for her. She has what's considered a, like a good job in Manhattan working at a gallery.
It's a job from a movie.
If you're an art history major, yeah, that's a Sex in the City job. That's legitimately a Sex in the City job. That's what Charlotte does.
No, that's the job that a character who goes home in a Hallmark movie back to her small town has that job, and she's about to like become the next thing, but instead she decides to stay with the guy who grows tomatoes in Arkansas or whatever the plot of one of those movies is. She's got one of those jobs.
Yeah. Usually he runs an inn, but you were close.
Yeah. She stays to run a crummy inn.
No, it's a beautiful inn where it's Christmas all the time in a Hallmark movie. A lot of Hallmark movies on at my job.
I mean, you've been in enough hotels to know that those people who run them do not look thrilled.
That's like, fair. They don't.
You got to deal with a lot of messes in a hotel. A lot of gross bathrooms.
But right. So she has reason to be depressed for sure. Right. She has reason to be unhappy.
And the book just starts with her unhappy. Something that I do like is that we don't work up to anything. She's already trying to sleep for a year when we open the book. Like page one.
Even at her job, she's sleeping in the closet during her lunch hour.
Yeah, it's not day one. She's been at this for a month or so by the way, when we meet her.
Right. Legitimately on her own, just trying to sleep as much as she possibly can.
Yeah. Which is also a feeling that I thought was fairly universal. That point of just being overwhelmed by your position at 25 and your position in life. This book really felt like 25, 26 to me, where obviously this is very heightened. I was not a person like our narrator in this book, but I do completely understand the confusion and fear about like the point of your life that you're in. I also understand the deep disdain for people your own age. Like I was very aware at 25 and 26 that I was in a group of people who felt very entitled and had contributed virtually nothing to the world, but felt like a sort of entitled ownership of it and of a future. Like I would go out to bars and stuff and look around at just all these like jackasses my own age and just be like, these people have given nothing, just nothing. Like first year on a job, like barely pay taxes.
But she is very our narrator is incredibly unlikable. Like she's not nice.
No. She's not nice.
No, my first unlike of her is with Reva, because you know Reva also has a reason to be sad. Reva's mother is dying of cancer. Our narrator has lost two parents, one to cancer, and she's horrible to Reva.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a quote. And this is like page 17. This is just like a right off the bat. You really don't feel bad for her because we don't know about her parents and stuff yet quite, or we don't have the story. But like in a conversation with Reva, like the first time we meet Reva, she says, the narrator says, "You'll be fine," I told Reva when she said her mother was starting a third round of chemo. "Don't be a spaz," I said when her mother's cancer spread to her brain.
It's not even just like she's tactless, and it's not even like she's trying to give her tough love. There's no point to it except meanness, except dismissiveness.
Right. It's just, yes, exactly. It's just dismissive and it's just unkind. It's put in I mean, I guess we're also supposed to look at it as like she only has one friend. She has one friend who like puts up with her, and she's continually, you know, pushing her away, I guess, trying to make this girl stop coming over and like stop caring about her. She doesn't want anybody to care about her, I guess.
She doesn't feel that
she deserves it or something.
She's also lost both parents and doesn't want to go through a third version of that via somebody else.
Right.
Like, she doesn't want to share Reva's sorrow in this. She's done it twice. She doesn't sound like she obviously didn't enjoy it either time. Who would? And she doesn't want to go through it again.
Right.
That's why she wants Reva to pack up her like problems and her sorrow and her sick mother and leave her alone. And she's not nice about it.
And that's a depressive attitude, right? Because sharing other people's pain isn't always great, but like, it's just what we do when we have relationships with people.
And I am not disagreeing with you. Our main character is mean, and she is consistently mean, and it's not from like a clever place or a point of view that like lends any kind of credence to it. But Reva also makes no attempt to like understand that our narrator's father died of cancer, and maybe she doesn't want to relive it.
It's true.
In fact, she never broaches the subject. She never says like, you know, like when your dad, there's no,
we don't see any of that. That's true. And she also doesn't, I mean, from an outside perspective, our narrator is killing herself, right? Like, and again, this is a reason that I think this is satire. If she was taking this many prescription drugs with this frequency for a year, would have serious health consequences, right?
Like, oh, she doesn't.
I'm not trying to poke holes in our magical realism or whatever. But my point being, like, this girl continues to come over to her house. She sees this like incredibly unhealthy lifestyle, and she doesn't, like, she's not digging to be like, what's going on here?
Here and there she does,
and towards the end she tries to take pills from her.
She chides her a little bit. Didn't the narrator ask her to take the pills? Or did
she was on Infermiterol, so I don't know that she...
Is it addressed?
So I think it's unclear. I think she wakes up. She encourages Reva to take one of the Infermiterols. She takes an Infermiterol, and then when she wakes up, Reva's taken all of her pills. So it's possible that she's asked Reva to do that, but we don't see it because it happens in one of the like 3-day...
That's why when I heard Otessa being like, I don't really think it's a satire, I was sort of like, I am someone who generally thinks that an author is the authority on their work. If they say it's not a satire, then it's not. But I was like, what is this then?
Right. Then what is it? Because some of this is, because this is pretty absurd to not be. Like I said, even just the sheer amount of pills she takes in a day at a time.
Well, and she doesn't eat. And for the 6-month run that she does, is it 6 months or 3 months when Ping Z?
Four. It's 4 months with Ping Z.
4 months with Ping Z. The only thing she eats is mushroom pizza.
Right.
I know she's taking multivitamins.
Occasionally,
but
she asks him to bring her some like other food. But yeah, like it's most exactly. And but again, just to circle back, you know, Reva's not digging very deeply.
No.
She is a little bit, right? She is giving this like surface level of care, this surface level of like, oh, you should be doing more. You should be getting out of the house.
But she's got a lot going on.
She's dispensing her little pearls of,
she's pregnant.
Of like self-help books. She's
pregnant
by her.
Reva's got a lot going on. She's sleeping with her married boss.
Sleeping with her married boss. Her mother is sick and dies.
Yeah. Her father's seeing someone else.
Her father starts seeing someone else. She's pregnant and preparing to have an abortion.
Yeah, Reva's got a full plate.
Reva does have a lot going on.
And your friend who doesn't have a job is super pretty and skinny and has a lot of money, maybe isn't the. But I mean, all
and
of that
it, and,
all,
and is mean to you all the time.
That's all there is in the book. That's everything we just described. Like that's 250 pages or whatever
this is. That's all of this. Is this? This pretty girl is trying to sleep. Sometimes she goes around the corner to the Egyptians at the bodega. I love the Egyptians.
I love the Egyptians at the bodega. I like the bodega. I like the Egyptians at the bodega. Why do I like this book, though? I guess because like that's where I was
why
going
does
with
any,
this.
why does anybody like this book? Sorry,
because I do really like it.
Why does anybody like this book? I actually was reading some articles in preparation, and that does seem to be a question that the internet is asking, because of course there is, of course, now that we are in 2024, there was a take that was like, you know, this is not, this is a poor, you know, this is bad for, this is a bad portrayal of mental health. What if people think that this is the solution?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I have that in the one stars, the like,
right, because there are people, the
comments from the cheap seats of people who are sort of like the, I think that's a lousy analysis. Like,
if you read this book and you think that this is a way to fix your depression, I won't go further. If you read this book and you think this is a way to fix your depression, I don't know what to say to you. I won't go further than that.
I don't put a lot of stock in literary analysis from people who think that everybody else's job is to make sure that people don't ever think the wrong thing by accident because of their own stupidity.
So there's some of that, but I mean, I think, you know, in this book comes out, or the setting of this book comes out 2018. The setting of this book though is a different and happier time. You know, this more like ebullient time rather, like in New York City. Prior to 9/11, and like that, but this book comes out, I mean, this book comes out 2 years before the pandemic, but I mean, it's really hitting its like height popularity around the time that we're going through the pandemic. We're in a polarizing political time in 2018, is how I'll phrase that. So this comes out and people, I think, are understanding a little bit like where this girl is at.
I guess that's true. It does. But I don't think that I like it because of, I don't think I'm associated with the pandemic. Like I find it interesting in a way that I can't quite put my finger on. I mean, it's not simply because I haven't read anything quite like it, although that does contribute. I haven't read anything quite like it, and that makes it interesting. But there's lots of stuff that I haven't seen or watched that I haven't really quite seen something like this, and I don't always love it. But I've not read anything quite like it. It's not super funny. It does have funny parts, but it's not like
It's darkly funny.
Some bits, but I mean, it's not like consistently like the way Fight Club is like occasionally funny, but like that's kind of a dark book. It's not like a rip roaring laugh a minute joke fest.
Right. It's not Confederacy of Dunces.
There you go. Yes, Confederacy of Dunces, which is lighthearted. Yes, it's lighthearted all the way through. That's like what we're there for. Bridget Jones, which is like we're here to have a good time.
People like sad pretty girls. Sad pretty girls is a genre. That's a thing that people like. She's thin and she's beautiful and she's rich and like she's still sad, and we're interested in that. People are interested in that. Virgin suicides.
Yeah,
sad,
that's
beautiful,
true.
Sad, beautiful girls.
I think the
book we should do for this podcast.
I would read that again, actually. We can talk about it now. It's a book podcast. We can talk about it right now.
We can talk about it right now. It is a book. Exactly.
I wonder, because I think people go back and forth between Middlesex and did he write The Marriage Plot?
I think so, yeah.
That's the one. I think people go back and forth between The Marriage Plot and The Virgin Suicides as his like opus. I'm not sure which. I've not read The Marriage Plot. I don't know anything about it. That's a thing I read somewhere, but I read Middlesex and The Virgin Suicides. But I would probably do any of his books that you picked if you want to, or you know what, if you're listening to this and you have a take on it, let us know. I'd be interested.
Yeah, let us know which of those books you would rather us read, and
which Jeffrey Eugenides book you think is like the book that is his pop classic.
And let us know what you think about Sad Pretty Girls, and if that's a topic that interests you, because I think that that's a topic that interests a lot of people. Prior to this podcast, Kennedy and I were discussing teen soaps, Riverdale specifically. And that also has Sad Pretty Girls. All teen soaps have Sad Pretty Girls. Marissa Cooper from The O.C.
Yeah. I guess, okay, it has sad, pretty girls in it.
Serena Vanderwoodson, Gossip Girl, right? People like sad, pretty girls.
It's not quite what you expect it to be. It is a unique point of view, and it has some funny and unique turns of phrase. And I do also, like, while some of her behavior is just unlikable with, like, no, seemingly no real impetus behind it, she does have some incredible takedowns. In particular, the alt boys from Brooklyn.
The sensitive artist. Yeah, I also made
sad young literary men, as I would think of them, just because of that Keith Gessen book. But do you care if I read the whole thing?
No, go for it. I had also made note of that.
Her takedown there is spot on, and also I think just very funny. She describes them as an alternative to the mainstream frat boys and pre-med straight and narrow guys. These scholarly, charmless, intellectual brats dominated the more creative departments. As an art history major, I couldn't escape them. Quote unquote dudes reading Nietzsche on the subway, reading Proust, reading David Foster Wallace, jotting down their brilliant thoughts into a black moleskin pocket notebook, beer bellies and skinny legs, zip-up hoodies, navy blue peacoats or army green parkas, New Balance sneakers, knit hats, canvas tote bags, small hands, hairy knuckles, maybe a deer head tattooed across a flabby bicep. They rolled their own cigarettes, didn't brush their teeth enough, spent $100 a week on coffee. They would come into Ducat, the gallery I ended up working at, with their younger, usually Asian girlfriends. They lamented the success of others. They thought that they wanted to be adored, to be influential, celebrated for their genius, that they deserved to be worshipped, but they could barely look at themselves in the mirror. They were all on Klonopin, was my guess. They lived mostly in Brooklyn, another reason I was glad to live on the Upper East Side. There's lots of bits like that that I think are actually like very well observed, very mean and pleasantly mean.
That's a note that I've also made, is that there are just these, I describe them as sharp observations, and they are of specifically New York things. But yeah, like sharp observations, the sensitive artists or sad young literary men, is absolutely one of them. Even Reva, like we talked about, you know, Reva is this kind of certain type of girl in her 20s living in New York, very specific. When she goes out to Long Island for Reva's mother's funeral, the descriptions of like small towns on Long Island, again, just very spot on. I mean, although I guess I would say maybe that's probably small towns in a lot of places, but they are mean. They are mean observations.
Yeah.
But they are sharp, and they are not necessarily untrue.
No, I mean, the book feels like a deliberate attack on just the mid-20s person, the mid-20s lifestyle, the mid-20s point of view, the mid-20s jobs and day-to-day life that like people live at that age. And it feels reflective. It feels like she's looking at her own life at some point, like having lived in it and like casting a judgment on it from there. And maybe that's what I like about it, is it just people don't often take the battering ram to themselves.
That's true. She is kind of judging herself as much as she's judging other people.
Like, I feel very much reading this that like Tessa Moshfegh has lived in this, or is looking at, like, this is observational. This is a life that she was like in or tangential to. I mean, everybody goes through their 20s. I mean, I'm sure there's people who like join the Peace Corps and do real things with that time, or have to work in a machine shop 9 hours a day to like make ends meet for their family. But this sort of like middle to upper class, like mid-20s existence, where you're on your way to becoming like an associate director at some company, like some sort of laptop job, it feels like it's an assessment of that, and a critical assessment of people at that age and the behaviors and things that are kind of, and also kind of like what's expected of them and what happens to them. And it's merciless in both, I think, the things that happen to people at that age, like the Reva's disappointment at her father, who she finds out has like been quietly waiting for her mother to die because he's been seeing someone else. I don't know, the abusive way that like Trevor treats the narrator, although she's not particularly great to Trevor either.
That is a sort of a mutually.
The backstory we're given, though, he was like 25 or 26 when she was in college. I feel like
he does have that older.
She's worked up to where she is now.
He does have that. He has that older advantage. Yeah, he meets her when she's young, and he's able to sort of manipulate her.
Yeah.
She kind of works up to also being able to sort of manipulate and terrorize him a little bit as well. But he again is an example of someone who likes sad, pretty girls. That's a lot of his attraction to her, is that she's sad, is that she's kind of messed up, right? And he really gets off on that. Or that's what she tells us.
Yeah.
And that's what we see in sort of snippets as we learn about their relationship, right? So he's reflective of that. So I think that's done on purpose, because again, I think Otessa Moshfegh sees that. I think that's part of what this book is, that like you were saying, like, what is it that I like about this? That's something people are interested in. I don't know what that says about us. I mean, I guess I think because we talk about beauty as being a privilege, or that, you know, women that are beautiful kind of, you know, men want them, girls want to be like them, kind of thing, right? So there's that, we feel that they're privileged and you kind of don't like them. So I think it's a little bit like Schadenfreude to see them being sad.
I think now that we're talking about it, there's also what you were saying about Trevor and that relationship, and like just kind of the pieces of that. I think if you've seen some of the things that she describes in here, the behaviors of someone like Trevor to like his younger girlfriend who he like finds at college, the way that a person in that, like our narrator in that experience, starts to ratchet up and learn how to like terrorize back that like toxic growth within a relationship, the sort of like casual disdain with which she treats Reva, and Reva's sort of equally casual dismissal of that, like if you've seen some of these things even fleetingly, or just had a bad year or whatever it is, I think seeing them observed and acknowledged and talked about and described is also probably very soothing.
Cathartic
and soothing, that like it's not just this one guy or girl that you dated. It's not just this one, like it wasn't just you who went through like this bad period between 24 and 20, whatever it is. Like you've having it acknowledged as an actual part of your life that you might have, you know, however deep or however shallow, been a part of, I think that probably feels good for a lot of people. And I think people who hate this book probably just had nicer things happen to them a lot, or just avoided people like this, or maybe just hated it so much they don't ever want to hear it described. But maybe like seeing some of these things just actually like put down on paper, you're sort of like, oh right, okay, so it's like a thing, it's not just me.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I think there are some people, and I don't want to say that they've led like charmed lives, because I'm sure everyone's had pain or something that, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone's had pain, right? Even if everything has gone really well for you, like maybe your grandparents still died, your pets don't live forever. I mean, something sad has happened, something that would have struck you and caused emotions, or someone's hurt your feelings, whatever it is. But there are people who I don't think have had quite such a blue existence, and I do think a lot of times those are people that I see that don't like these dark books.
No, I think there's people
or,
with just cheerier
dark movies or dark TV shows or whatever. They have like this cheerier outlook on life, and it's just like, you know, oh, I think this is terrible. Like this is so dark, and it's like
I did not mean to suggest that those people had like never had anything happen to them. I will clarify. I didn't mean that they had a charmed existence. I just mean they're sunnier people.
Oh sure.
Like they're just, I think just.
But I
perhaps people who bounce back a little bit better, people who are just maybe a little bit more disposed to like getting over.
I mean, I've met those people in person as well, and seen that they, you know, they don't like stuff like this.
No, you know who I love in this book? Dr. Tuttle.
Dr. Tuttle wins this book for me 100%. She is the best. She is the best character in this book. She's the most likable character in this book. I know she shouldn't be. Clearly she's a horrible doctor, but
just every little bit with her is such a great monologue. It's such a funny, weird little thing. The part where she's like, I don't mean metaphorically, and I don't mean literally. I mean like parenthetically, and then she makes her hands into little things, which is nonsense, but I just think it's a very funny. Like
everything from her is endlessly quotable. Endlessly
yeah.
quotable. I love that she consistently has some problem. Like it's the neck brace. Like initially the neck brace comes and goes. She consistently has like her own problems going on. I love that she refers to her cat when she picks, she has so many cats and she picks one up to hit as her eldest.
I also just like that she's unflappable though, where she's just like, she's always got like a thing going on where she's just sort of like, I got this table and I'm starting to do this. Like, what is it? Mystic massages or whatever.
Yeah. Thing, just something, some nonsense. And I like that she just very clearly from, you know, from the get go is like, I know how to work over insurance companies.
Yeah, I like all
she
of
just
that.
Very much from the beginning is like, I'm going to write you a bunch of prescriptions and I know how to get them paid for. I really enjoy that. My favorite quote from her, if I might read it. People would be so much more at ease if they acted on impulse rather than reason. That's why drugs are so effective in curing mental illness, because they impair your judgment. Don't try to think too much.
Yeah, all of that's so good. Every scene that she's in, she's just, yeah, she also wins the book for me. Like she's the best part, the best character. Do you want to get into the categories?
Yeah, let's before we do, I just wanted to call a couple things. One, titular line a few times right in the beginning. Page 12, I think it was the quote you read to open us up.
It sums up the book very well, but yeah, it also has, I like a titular line.
I love a titular line. And it's in there twice. There's two titular lines in there, and I enjoy that. Another book that references Nimbutol and Secanols.
Yes.
The other Valley of the Dolls callback. I love how many books have come back to Valley of the Dolls or have like mentioned them or had something from them. Has thrilled me. So what I was thinking of in this book, there's not a ton of discussion about this, but just that I wanted to bring up is the sleep cure from Valley of the Dolls. Jennifer North goes to Sweden or something. She goes to like another country, where they basically just put her under.
I forgot about that. They do. They just send her to an.
They just put her under so that she can lose
so
weight.
So much happens in that book.
But they.
So
but
much goes on in Valley of the Dolls.
So much goes on in Valley of the Dolls, which is why so many other. We were able to talk about it with so many other books, I guess. But so they do it for her so that she can have. She can lose weight. I think she gets like a few surgeries done or whatever in the time. And she's just under for all of it. And when she wakes up, she's, you know, thinner and more beautiful and ready for America. But the principle behind it was for mental health. That's also why that's how they get Neely to the mental institution, is with the promise of the sleep cure. She thinks that she's just going to sleep and sort of get past her trauma. And that is what we're told. That's what we're told in the book, that the sleep cure was meant for. I do think that is rooted in like an actual study or something that was done during that time.
I mean, if you've ever felt depressed or been depressed, I know, or just felt overwhelmed or like racked by anxiety with work or whatever it is, the idea of just like, screw it, I'll like just staying in bed is very appealing.
Sleep is a way of avoiding her problems.
Yeah. I completely get that. Just sort of like, both my parents died. I hate everything. What if I just go away for a year into my bed and just sleep and I don't think about it? And I'll just see what happens on the other side. Like, it must be better.
Right.
But I think that's rooted in a very human impulse.
But I mean, and she does think about it, right? She goes through a phase where she's having all of these dreams about her parents. You know, she's not able to escape it, right? Like even in her year of rest and relaxation, she's not able to escape these things. She's not able to escape Trevor.
I guess when I say I've never read anything quite like it, I mean, besides the fact it's like an oddity of a book, there is also that it's a very active pursuit, right? Like, she's not depressed, and as a result of the depression, in a lot of books, we're like, you know, we just see through the story that like she's sleeping a lot, she can't get out of bed, she's draggy. She is actively pursuing this as a means of dealing with her depression. Like, she's very aware that like, I want to get in that bed and I don't want to get out of it.
That's true. She's not approaching
No, she's
not,
like
not acknowledging that she's sad, that she's sad, that she has problems. That she has problems, and that she is actively trying to solve them. She is just going about it in a way that's like,
no, super unhealthy. But
you could go to an actual therapist. You go to an actual therapist and maybe some antidepressants. There's another way to go about this, but she is trying to take matters into her own hands. She does acknowledge that she's like an unhappy person.
Yeah, no, she's trying to make, I mean, she's making an attempt to be more than just the person to whom depression is acted upon. She is making an effort to be the doer, the person who like takes a step like that addresses her situation. Maybe it's not the healthiest or the most recommended or even all that realistic, but she's taking an active interest in what is going on with her and like taking a step that she has chosen.
I agree. That's a good point.
Do you want to do Bechdel?
Yes.
Does this pass the Bechdel test?
This handily passes the Bechdel test. Yeah, lots of conversations between her and Reva, her and Dr. Tuttle, and they...
Maybe the maybe the easiest pass since Little Fires Everywhere. Right?
Yeah, and they don't never have to do with Ben, but I mean the conversation topics are wide and varied and seldom, for what it's worth, about men.
No, they're mostly not. And there are many female characters within the book. It's not even just the two of them. There is from Dr. Tuttle to our main character's mother. The woman who owns the gallery, many other female characters.
Lots of female characters. But yeah, easy Bechdel pass on this one.
A lot of like verbal violence, woman to woman.
sure.
But it does pass.
There are great relationships between women, but there's lots of conversations between women.
All right, you want to do our Chuck Taylor one stars?
Yes.
Okay, so. This book's one-star reviews actually had people who made, not actually, many of them have. There are some legitimate takes in the one stars, which I point out just because whenever you read through the one-star reviews, and because we do a podcast where it's a whole section, spend a lot of time in there. There are these like comments from the cheap seats, as I think of it. I have cataloged those and we'll rip through them. They're not the ones I want to talk about, but unlikable main characters, non-PC takes and dialogue, one that you mentioned earlier, mental disorders are not addressed with the respect and care that they should be according to the sort of online purveyors of how you talk about these things. Bulimia, similarly, not addressed according to the care and so forth that in real life, if you were actually trying to like help a person who is suffering from this, that you would take. Almost as though these are fictional characters doing the wrong thing. But Asians are referenced more than one time in non-laudatory ways.
Well, an example of that, I think, is the quote you read about our sad young literary men and how they often have Asian girlfriends.
That's one. And there's another line that I left out because I just wanted to do the description, but that there's some little bit of banter mixed into that where, what is it? Reva says guys with Asian girlfriends have small dicks, which doesn't really feel derogatory towards Asians specifically, more like guys who, but whatever. Anyhow, all of this is noted. I do want to say, but sexual assault is not treated with the seriousness it should, and that she's just a privileged, rich girl who doesn't even need to work, so she shouldn't be able to have problems. So those are all in there as you expect them to be. The one-star reviews that I want to talk about that I think are a little bit more meaningful, one that comes up a lot is that there is no actual meaning to this book. And we talked about this a little bit in our like sort of summary discussion where her cruelty sometimes doesn't seem to have any impetus behind it. It's not there for a satirical reason. It's kind of just cruelty. It kind of catches you when you realize there's no real reason for her to just be so mean. It stands out.
It does. Yeah. And that's what I think contributes to like the unlikability is just like there. Yeah. Like there's no need to be this mean.
But this take, when people discuss it within the one stars, kind of goes further where they're, people are just sort of like, there's no point to that. Like her relationships with men that are brought up, there is no, there's no point of view on them and like no meaning to them. And so forth. Like there just really isn't, it doesn't get at anything. And I read this one and I struggle with it because I like this book, but I can't really tell you what it means. That's not true. It's not untrue.
It's not untrue. I don't know that they're.
I mean, I think a little bit of a little bit of her cruelty or her dismissiveness, for instance, of Reva's like personal anguish at like what's going on with her mother is, I think, probably rooted in the fact that she's gone through this twice and does not feel like she wants to share it again. Like it's just not, I did two of these, thanks. I don't need to do a third tour. But like the ones about her relationship with men, like her relationships with Trevor, doesn't really drive at anything, like even about men or about relationships. Like it's sort of so specifically horrible that it doesn't really layer over any kind of like general feeling or general behavior, I don't think.
No, it's just another thing that's happened to her. It's just like another thing she's depressed about and contending with. It's just like another reason for her to sleep for a year.
The second one that comes up a lot, and this one I think is interesting, is that the 9/11 stuff is tacked on and weird and also meaningless. And I kind of want to talk about this one because why is 9/11 in this book?
The end of this book.
So I'm sorry to interrupt. Lots of people pointed out that this book stole the ending from that weird Robert Pattinson movie where like out of nowhere it turns out Robert Pattinson's job interview that day is on September 11th in the morning in one of the Twin Towers, and like that's how that like rom-com ends.
I know what you're talking about. Because she's so cheerful through it.
When you say mean for the 150 words that it takes up in this book on the very last page? It's barely two paragraphs.
Yes, I do. Yes, that is what I mean. The end of this book is weird. I don't love that her sleep cure, like, quote unquote, works.
Okay, that's the third one.
Yeah.
So let's talk about these two things
so
together,
I mean,
because they happen
being,
very
like,
quickly at the end.
Yeah, that it's just like, okay, so she just like comes out of her apartment. Okay, I do appreciate that she comes out of her apartment and passes out in the lobby because.
I do
like
so
she's
that is kind of
funny. She hasn't like left her apartment. Was like, all right, yeah. I appreciate that we're acknowledging some like physical ramifications of this. And it takes her a little bit, right? She has to like build up to like be able to go walk around and whatever. So I appreciate that. But yeah, it's like she just comes out and it's like, oh, the world is new and everything's great and everything's fine and like now I feel really good. And she's just like out wandering around feeding squirrels. Like she still doesn't have to work or anything. I would also feel great if I just like didn't have to work or anything. And could just go to the park, feed squirrels all day.
I mean, she doesn't have to work.
She's just cheerful through 9/11 where her best friend dies.
I just want to remind you, she doesn't have to work because her parents are dead.
Sure.
Like but it's not, point... she didn't, she's not like the heir to the Pepsi fortune.
I know and I appreciate that, but like yeah, she just comes out and isn't doing anything. She's happy. Reva dies. Like we know when Reva's like, oh, I'm gonna get, you know, she gets the promotion at work because Ken wants to get rid of her, and it results in her getting a promotion, and like, oh, you know, they're sending, at least they get to go down to the towers. Like she's excited about that. That's cool. But yeah, she's just kind of like cheerful through this horrible thing happening that does result in like somebody she knows dying in a way that's terrible. She doesn't hate Reva. Like they're not friends at that point, but like, she doesn't hate this person.
She calls her. She remembers her birthday when she wakes up.
Right. So it's like you,
so I go back and forth on
the
like,
you should feel sad that Reva dies in these towers, like dies in 9/11.
I go back and forth on the, like the fact that it works. Like there's a piece of me that is like, that's ballsy to just be like, and you know what? My character was right. She feels great. You should let me sleep for a year. That's what we should all do. We should like sleep through 26. Like there's a little piece of me that's just sort of like, oh, okay. Like it's not like the expected thing, which is that like, and I didn't feel what really made me happy was X. What really made me happy, it wasn't what I was trying the whole time. It was whatever. Like Fight Club does that. We're like, look, this didn't make me happy. I thought it would.
I suppose that would also be a trite ending. Like, if that is how it had ended, I don't know that I would be like, well, that was the ending I wanted.
But I also agree that it feels ridiculous that it worked.
It feels ridiculous. And then the 9/11 thing, like I said, feels weird because she's just like, it's fine. It's fine that this happened.
So I have a take on this. I think that sometimes our artists don't know how to end things. And so they just put some stupid shit at the end. And I think that's what happened here.
I mean, that's legitimate. Every paper or essay I ever had to write in school, like, I would write this great paper and then I'd get to the end and be like, damn, I feel like I got to put some like real heavy, like something real heady and like awesome at the end of this. And it's like, that's hard to do. So I'm not, that's fair. That's a really good.
Did you ever see that Denis Villeneuve, I'm probably saying his name wrong, movie before Dune with Jake Gyllenhaal, where like Jake Gyllenhaal's a professor or something who finds a guy who looks exactly like him, also played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and they have this sort of like doubles thing going on where like he follows the guy and then the guy gets mad and then the guy follows him, and it's this sort of like thriller of like why is this guy who looks exactly like me out there living this other life, and then it gets to the end and one of the Jake Gyllenhaals walks into his house and he's married to a giant spider and that's the end of the movie.
No, but that's kind of an awesome end.
Okay, so there's all this stuff online about, like, what does it mean, and where's the... And I'm telling you, Denis Villeneuve got to the end and was like, I had a cool concept, and, like, it was a fun thing to write, and I got to the end, and, like, it doesn't have an ending, so, like, I don't know, he's married to a spy. Like, that's what he did. It doesn't... If decades go by of people trying to parse meaning out of it, it doesn't mean... It's not there. or it's so arbitrary that it might as well not be there. And I think that's what happened here, was she was just like, I don't know, man. And then 9/11 happened and she's like, that woman's jumping into the future. There, it's over. I'm done. The end. Publish it. Picador. Or no, who published this? Vintage.
I mean, our main character does say, like, she does see, you know, because again, we're in this like pre-9/11 New York. So she is kind of commenting sometimes on like all these other people are out here just like, they're having a life, they're happy, they're okay with being awake.
People are doing that in post 9/11 New York. People are doing that today.
People are doing that today. People are doing that are doing that everywhere. But she doesn't understand it. She feels outside, she feels othered from that. She feels outside of that. And then she wakes up from her sleep cure, as it were, her Valley of the Dolls sleep cure. And she makes a comment. It's like, oh, now I understand the language of people who were happy or whatever. But yeah, but the 9/11 thing is like, okay, but now nobody in New York is happy but you. Everyone else is unhappy, is afraid. They've probably lost people that they like.
Oh, do you think that's it?
Or loved? Maybe. This is just coming to me now because I remembered.
That's interesting.
I remember that
you
she
think...
comes out and it's like, oh, now I understand like how everybody else, you know, how all these other people are happy. But like I said, with 9/11, it's like, okay, so, but yeah, but like now nobody in New York is. I didn't live there during that time, but like, I understand that to have been, if you knew nobody in the Twin Towers, if you knew no first responders, if you knew nobody who was, I want to say like directly affected by that event, like, living there would make you be directly affected by the event and feel afraid. When I first moved to New York, I didn't have a TV yet. All I had was like my clock radio. And you know those like those giant like booms that happen sometimes from like, I don't know if they have like electrical companies. You're just like in your house and you hear giant like explosion.
Sometimes
sound.
They also drop one of those giant steel plates over a hole they've just dug in the road.
Yeah.
But sometimes so like, it is also Con Ed.
So what? Right. It was a Con Ed or something. I was asleep early in the morning. I had, like I said, I had just moved there. I'd lived there for like a few weeks. Like I said, I didn't have a TV or anything yet. And this was, you know, this was pre like iPhones. I didn't have internet in my apartment yet. And one of those giant booms happened. And like, I thought there was like a 5 minute period that I just assumed somebody had like dropped a bomb on New York City because this was 2000, six. You know what I mean? So this is not a lot of years after 9/11.
No. I remember the vibe. Yeah.
I had to put on like the, I don't know. I turned like my radio on and like on Z100 listening to be like, did something horrible happen? And like, I don't know, the Z Morning Zoo was just on there talking about
there's no
Duran or something. I don't, you know,
no useful information coming out of the Z Morning Zoo.
Yeah, it was just what was on But then I was like scrolling through radio stations to be like, did something happen? Like I looked out the windows and stuff. And then I kind of like I said, I was asleep when this happened. So I did kind of come to and realize that it was Con Ed or something had dropped or it was a truck or whatever.
Maybe you're onto something. So maybe we're thinking about this wrong.
But nobody in New York is happy.
No, maybe that's the point, is that like, so you read it and you're just sort of like, oh, it worked. And then you get this 9/11 ending where maybe what we're supposed to think is just like, oh, it didn't work. She is just as fucked up as she was before. Like, she's not better. Sorry, you're just rewinding and watching over and over again Reva fall out of the Twin Towers, thinking that she's jumping into a bright future. You are absolutely not okay. It did not work. You keep going in with like just a different form of like problem. Maybe that's
a different
how
form of problem. Yeah. Like now you've made yourself happy or whatever, but like now this is a time that like I said, like even if
no, you can only be happy when everybody else is not.
Even if you live here, you were fearful. You're fearful. The city has changed. These are at minimums, right? This is like at the minimum if you live.
Maybe you just solved the ending. Maybe that's the like, she gets better and you're reading it. You're kind of lulled into thinking like, oh, huh, seems like a cheap ending. And then we get the 9/11 final page where maybe what we are intended to realize is that it did not work. It did not make this damaged person better. She is now like only happy because the entire city is not. She's misunderstood this major event. She's not okay. It did not make her a better person. It did not make her better at all.
She just thinks that she's better because now everybody's unhappy, just like she is.
Well, she's different, but she's not better because she's just watching Reva fall out of a tower over and over and over again and like misunderstanding that that is sorrowful and that that is terrible and tragic and like horrific. And has this completely whacked out take on what it means. And that's our like M. Night Shyamalan twisting at the end, like, oh, she didn't get better. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Look
that
at
makes
me.
More sense.
Oh, look. Yeah. Oh,
no,
please.
No.
Yeah.
I think
okay.
You just, I
we
think,
solved. We
I think
solved
you just,
it.
I think you just solved my year of rest and relaxation.
Awesome. Yeah.
Okay. That's the best one it. Stars we've ever done then.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Let's do Stephen Hawking's. So let's do Stephen Hawking's casting call.
Can I start?
Yes, you can.
Okay. I'm most excited about my casting for Reva, which is Zosia Mamet. So for my girl, my HBO Girls fans, that's Shoshana.
Oh,
from
that's
Girls.
That's exactly hooch.
If there was somebody who was born to play Reva, it's Zosia Mamet.
Yeah, that's a good call. She was also my favorite character on Girls.
She's the best person she's definitely my favorite character on Girls.
For the season that I saw. Is she still in stuff?
She actually just did a show on Netflix. She just did this. Okay, hang on. I got to look it up. I forgot. I watched it all the way through, but I forgot the name of it. So I had a lot going on. Oh. So she's on Netflix. There's a show called The Decameron, and it takes place in Italy during the plague, and it is super dark humor, and it is real weird, and it is like 10 episodes, and it is 1,000% worth the watch.
Okay, I like her.
Just sort of a bunch of like underrated comedians in it. One of the main characters from Dairy Girls is in it. I'm sure she has.
You had me at Dairy Girls. You don't have to go any farther.
She has a Gaelic name that I'll.
You've had me at Dairy Girls. If one of them is in it, I'm in. Fine. Great.
One of the Dairy Girls is in it. Zosia Mamet's in it.
Yeah,
it has some other sort of like underrated comedians. It is real weird. It's 10 episodes. It's like a limited series, and it is worth the watch.
I did Anna Kendrick for Reva.
Oh, Anna Kendrick she's a good cast for Reva. Yeah.
It is a more mainstream casting, but I was trying to pick people who I thought were like, Anna Kendrick is funny. For our unnamed narrator, I didn't intend to stay inside the Pitch Perfect universe, but I had two. I had Elizabeth Banks, like a knocked up era Elizabeth Banks.
Mm-hmm. She's a good call.
Because she's funny. And she also, I think, has the look that like our main character is supposed to have.
Yeah, she's a good pick.
She looks like Elizabeth Banks, right? Like, the other one is Brie Larson, who I think is funnier than people realize.
Brie Larson is, I think, funnier than people realize, and she. Oh yeah, I could see her having a good. I could see her doing this role well.
Who else did you cast? I couldn't think of anyone for Trevor, or I could think of everyone for Trevor.
I cast Reva, the narrator, Trevor, and Dr. Tuttle. So for the narrator...
Like Trevor is like who I want to be... Oh, wait, no, do the narrator first.
So the narrator... Okay, so I was also... Okay, Zosia Mammoth was my... That was the one I was most
That's a good
about.
One. That's who... That's when we do it, that's who it should be.
About my cast for the narrator. However, okay, so my cast for the narrator is Margot Robbie.
Oh, I circled around her, but I...
But then, when I was reading some things, apparently Margot Robbie has acquired the film rights for this, which I did not know when I picked her. I picked her because she...
Oh, really?
I picked her because she's so friggin' pretty that even if she was meant to look not pretty and slovenly, like our narrator, she's gonna nail it. Because, like, the narrator keeps, like, checking herself out in mirrors and being like, yeah, I'm still attractive, even though I look like shit.
She's also, I'm always blown away that she's not American.
Margot Robbie's not American?
Right? No, she's fucking Australian.
Wow. Oh, I had no idea.
No, I know. I heard her speak with an Australian accent, and I thought she was playing a part, but no, apparently that's her real life.
Oh, wow. Yeah, she's so American looking. Or just something
just
about her is
there's also
American.
Just no trace of an accent.
Of an accent. Not like, even, at no. All. She, I would have, I'm blown away by that.
She sounds like she's from Ohio.
Yeah, apparently she's acquired the film rights to this. I didn't have the chance to dig deeper into that, but then I felt
she's gonna
like,
play if she's in it, she's gonna play the mom.
At this point, yes. Yeah. But remember, this is Stephen Hawking's casting call because
these people
could be any age. I'm saying that for our listeners. We call this Stephen Hawking's casting call because we're not taking current age into account a lot of times when we're doing the casting. Yeah, she'll play the mother. You're probably right about that. But yeah, so she had acquired the film rights to this, and that made me feel like my choice was less unique. But for what it's worth, I did not know that when I picked her.
Margot Robbie is also the most beautiful, capable actress, like working by some like Gal Gadot's like very pretty, but she's not really an actress, right? I mean, I know she's act. I know that we let her act. I'm just saying, it's not like she should have
Margot
a different
Robbie,
job.
Margot Robbie is an excellent actress.
Yeah, she's actually a real actor,
and she is stunning.
Yeah, the beautiful that like is required of this.
How Cameron Diaz is amazingly beautiful and just a legitimately very funny girl.
Yeah, and like you could say like I mean, you could pick like Tandy Newton or someone like that, but like I think these characters are so definitively white.
She's so definitively like she's so definitively like this white blonde.
Yeah. There's
a real specificity to what she is meant to look like. You can play with Reva a little more.
But like
I picked someone who does a lot of times who I do think is Jewish and a lot of times plays Jewish character in Zosia Mammoth.
Oh, okay.
But I also just thought.
Yeah, okay. You could play. Yeah, that's as far as you. I think you could play with Reva, though. Like, I think if
but
you cast
Reva
a,
could,
a
Reva,
black
we
actor
could play with
for Reva, I feel like you're. I mean, fine, whatever. Who cares? But I think Reva is pretty definitively white. Also,
she's a Long Island Jewish girl.
Yeah.
Right. That's specific.
Yeah, it's very specific.
It's specific. The narrator is also, she's an upstate New York white girl. She comes from a specific. Yeah, they're very specific. I did cast Trevor as James Franco.
No, that's a good.
He does douchebag well, and he's very handsome.
It's funny you say him.
Younger James Franco.
Because the person I want to play Trevor is Danny McBride, who is patently not correct for it, but he could behave in a way that is perfect for this. He is not the like.
He's not handsome. He has to be. He has to be good looking.
Yes, because something that's interesting about this book.
Christian Bale would also be. Because so, of, like he
American
because,
Psycho
because but, Trevor is American Psycho basically right
when I was reading this sometimes the book feels as though our unnamed narrator is a secondary character in other books, like as though she is like a secondary character in an American Psycho style book that Trevor is the main character in,
yeah,
or she is a secondary character in the like, you know, sort of grief novel of like a young Jewish girl from Farmingdale, Long Island, who's like in the city and her mom's back in Farmingdale dying of cancer and her father's seen another woman, like just this sort of like literary novel like that, that, you know, there's like a slovenly best friend who's in it and it's right. Our narrator and like Reva's the main character in that, or Dr. Tuttle, who is in a comedy novel about like a comedy satire about like, you know, these kinds of people in New York, she's like a Wes Anderson character.
She's in a Wes
Anderson style, like novel or movie. And like, this is just one of the patients that comes through in a couple of like, I can't tell if that's intentional, if that's just the way I'm reading it, but, did you do the mom and dad?
No, the only other one I did was Dr. Tuttle.
So for the mom, I did Robin Wright Penn. I just feel like that's a sort of steely.
Yeah. That's an excellent cast.
And for the dad, it's the dad from Clarissa Explains It All. I didn't look up his name. I don't care what it is, but it's the guy who played Clarissa's dad on Clarissa Explains It All.
I can picture him immediately. I know his is in my head, and he would be a good
Yeah, that's the dad.
Because the dad is definitely just like a guy that's the dad. Dad on Clarissa Explains It All.
I do like my Dr. Tuttle. Who's yours?
Meryl Streep. Like Death Becomes Her.
Meryl Streep would kill.
Because Dr. Tuttle, I don't think is very old.
Deeply underrated movie, Death Becomes Her.
Death Becomes Her is an excellent movie. I think they're remaking it for Broadway or something.
Oh, that should be terrible. But
I'm sure it's going to be horrible. But that's a great movie. So yeah, I'm thinking like young, you know, younger 40-something Meryl Streep.
So mine was Annie Mumolo. Annie Mumolo is perhaps most famous for co-writing Bridesmaids. She's Kristen Wiig's writing partner. She's also in Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. She's Barb.
Oh, and she's in Bad Moms. I'm pulling up a picture of her now. I have to look, see what she looks like.
So there's a movie called. Yeah. There's a movie called Confess Fletch with Mad Men. His name just flew out of my head, but the guy from Bridesmaids and Mad Men. The handsome guy.
Don Draper. Don Draper.
It doesn't matter.
It's not his name.
It doesn't matter what his name is. He plays Fletch from like the Fletch movies, right? But it's like a
John Hamm.
John Hamm. Okay,
I'm sorry, it would also just not pop into my brain.
No, it's it didn't get out released in theaters because we don't release mid-budget comedies in theaters anymore for whatever not for whatever reason, because they don't make enough money. They don't make as much money as Marvel movies. But she's in that movie and she has this like, she has like 6 minutes of screen time, and she just kills it. She is absolutely like one of the best. There's a lot of good things in that movie. She's so good in her like 6 minutes. I recommended it for the whole thing is good, I think, but like she's great in that, and she would be a perfect Dr. Tuttle. Who's yours?
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. No, my Dr. Tuttle was Meryl Streep. No, that's okay. And we did the parents. You did the parents. Those were good. Those are good choices for the parents.
So who's your, you know who you look like? You know who you remind me of? The one I can never remember the name of.
You know who you remind me of. So I have a handful. So the obvious, because this is kind of part of this little like series we've done with Bret Easton Ellis and Joan Didion. So I mean, this does remind me of like Play It As It Lays, Less Than Zero, Fight Club.
So can we talk about Fight Club for a second?
Those were all callbacks for me. Absolutely.
So I mentioned this book in our Fight Club episode because I feel that this has just a lot. I also confessed in our Fight Club episode, and I'll confess it again, I do not know Otessa Moshfegh.
Personally. Never.
No, I don't. She's never talked to me. But I feel very much like she's read Fight Club and never talked to me one time. she's read Fight Club, and that it had... I'd like to offer you my reading of My Year in Rest of Relaxation, or the way I read it, is that our unnamed narrator, like in Fight Club, has invented Reva as a way of trying to normalize her grief, and Reva does not really exist. They are the same person. I present this not just because of the like unnamed narrator, Fight Club, unnamed narrator, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, but because of the mirroring that goes on throughout the book, like the two characters run in parallel in lots of ways. There is the parental death. Our narrator's father dies of cancer, and Reva's mother is dying of cancer. The abandonment of the other parent, or the abandonment like from the other parent. So like Reva, like it's the father who is clearly like just kind of checking out, like doing something else. For our main character, it's the mother, and like the parent that dies is the one that was the least offensive of the parents. The fact that no one in the book else in the book ever sees Reva or talks to her. Like even when we go to the funeral, well, actually, let's start with the funeral. When we go to the funeral, no one talks to like Reva when she comes into the house. No one like really interacts with either of the ladies like in it. And our character just goes downstairs and like sleeps through it. She just goes down there and she thinks about like her own parents' grief. And there's that line that I think kind of sums up like part of the relationship, which is like Reva is, you know, she Hallmark cards every kind of like deeply emotional experience and makes it trite. And that allows our main character to bat her feelings away, her feelings about like how Reva feels away, and therefore bat also away her own bad feelings about her own parents and her own depression. And then like when they get up and go to the funeral, like there is no sort of interaction with anybody. And when she goes out there, she's wearing like the sleek rabbit fur coat, and like Reva goes stomping out of that house in like a brown stodgy beaver coat or whatever it is.
She goes and gets like her mom's fur. Yeah.
Yes. And we never find like, there's all these things. I don't seriously believe that the text is wants us to think that.
I think that. I like that. That's an interesting theory. I can see that. Yeah. Cause you're right. No one else really interacts with Reva. And I mean,
well, and part of it was that like at the end, the imaginary character disappears on the top of a building, and like, she's finally gone and out of our main character's life, which is how Fight Club ends.
Right.
And like the reaction of our like narrator before you solved it a minute ago, the reaction of our narrator is so nonsensical that like that's it, like she brings Reva over one last time after she feels better and tells her goodbye, and then that's it, she's gone. She like sends her imaginary friend to the World Trade Center and she dies in 9/11. That's until you started talking about like the ending a minute ago, and we went down that whole thing. That was how I was choosing to interpret this book. Again, I don't seriously think that it's in the text, but I like that reading of it.
My other, you know, who you remind me of, are just other like satires. So like Animal Farm, Confederacy of Dunces, a little bit being kind of like satirical, The Sellout. And then this one's out there. So I read this book some years ago called The Natural Way of Things.
Don't know it.
By Natalie Wood, I think is the author.
Natalie. Natalie Wood's the name of that woman that died on the boat. An actress.
Charlotte Wood. That's why I was thinking, Natalie. I was like, no, it's Wood. I can picture the spine of it, Charlotte Wood. This book, it's called The Natural Way of Things, and about a group of women. They're imprisoned in the middle of like a desert in like the Australian bush. And what they all have in common is that they've all like disrupted society. They've all had like scandals and stuff. They've just done things that aren't like becoming for women. One of them has like a sex scandal, you know, it's like a sex tape or something. All of these ways in which they've sort of like wronged society as women, and then they get shoved into this like prison camp out in the middle of like the Australian outback. I've never met anybody else that's read it, and I think I maybe gave it to one of my friends because I enjoyed it so much. So she's maybe the only other person I've ever discussed with that's read it. I don't remember how I came across it.
Well, recommend it here. Tell our listeners to go out and
the natural way of things by Charlotte Wood.
Go to your bookstore, your little library in your neighborhood, your real library in your neighborhood, or to Thrift Books. Try to skip Amazon if you can. Thriftbooks.com also has free delivery. The books are often cheaper. And get The Natural Way of Things by Charlotte Wood.
Yeah, and it was a really excellent book. And that was like it, reminding of me, I think, maybe just the feminine like aspect of it, and you know, they're punished for, you know, they're like punished for acting badly. Essentially, it was really interesting, and I think maybe it's also really dark. So I think maybe that's part of what kind of reminded me why that was like a callback for me for this one.
All right. You want to do quotes? I'll do three.
Well, I did one from Dr. Tuttle. I have a couple.
I'll start. This is our narrator, obviously, near the beginning. And she says, "I was both relieved and irritated when Reva showed up, the way you'd feel if someone interrupted you in the middle of suicide." Poor Reva, I guess. I think that. But again, it sort of supports my like theory that she's a non-corporeal entity who has just popped up because of all the drugs and sleep deprivation in our narrator's life.
I have two that are also about Reva. So Reva comes, you know, Reva's over there and just being, you know, being herself. The narrator says, "Have you ever heard the expression, eat shit or die?" I asked. Reva unscrewed the tequila and poured more into her can. "It's eat shit and die," she said. And I just love that that's her response to our narrator telling her, "Eat shit or die." Actually, it's eat shit and die.
That's the thing. She's very dismissive of
this, like,
there's
bad
something,
behavior, as this rude behavior, as it were,
which is what we're impressed by as like the reader, is just like how terrible she would be to her. But there is a certain like pushback to refusing to acknowledge someone's bad behavior, like just skipping right over the like little tantrum you're having.
That's true. It's a great tactic. It works really well. It works well with children. I work with older adults that sometimes have dementia, and it works sometimes for that as well. Of just like, I'm just gonna push past you telling you to F off and leave your room because I can't. I'm just going to keep going. Like, you didn't just say that to me. And then that's how I'm going to deal with this. Yeah. I mean, it is a good method.
My next one is also a conversation with Reva, where they watched Before Sunset, and our narrator, Reva, makes a comment that Judy Delpy in that movie has arm flab. And our narrator says, "Does it make you happy that Judy Delpy has arm flab?" I'd asked her. "No," she said after some consideration. "Happiness is not what I'd call it. More like satisfaction."
Mine is also about Reva. So she's, our narrator's kind of explaining that she wants to just sleep. Reva says, "At least I'm making an effort to change and go after what I want. Besides sleeping, what do you want out of life?" I chose to ignore her sarcasm. "I wanted to be an artist, but I had no talent," I told her. "Do you really need talent?" That might have been the smartest thing Reva ever said to me.
Okay, so that was my third one also. That's a great pick.
And I do have one thing that I want to bring up that is not a quote, but that I really enjoyed. Our narrator's AOL screen name is Whoopi Goldberg 2000.
Yes. We didn't really talk about her Whoopi Goldberg obsession, but I...
Whoopi Goldberg and Harrison Ford.
Yeah. Whoopi Goldberg is like an oddly perfect pick because she's ubiquitous in a way. And she's been around since you and I were kids. And she, and,
yeah,
and,
been and
you
for
and,
a long time.
And you and I inherited her. She didn't like pop when we were younger. She was like established.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
we just,
no, she
we
was
did,
just already around.
Yeah, we caught her in the upswing of like Sister Act and Ghost, in those movies. And she's just keep, she was on TV yesterday. She's on, isn't she on The View? She's like still,
I think she's still on The View. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, until the first time I read this book, I'd forgotten she had been on Star Trek.
I forgot she was on Star Trek too. I don't know that I ever, I mean, I'm sure it was on some when I was a kid, but I don't like, I didn't watch it as like an adult.
So I think we, do we recommend this book?
If you were a person, if you were a person with a sunny disposition who does not enjoy dark books, then you've probably not enjoyed this little run that we've done of Play It As It Lays and Less Than Zero and Fight Club. And so if that is you, then I would not necessarily recommend this book because it is dark. But if you can find, if you can find some humor in that, or you enjoy a little bit of comic darkness, then I would absolutely recommend this book. If you have lived in New York City at all, I would also recommend this book. I think you would enjoy sort of the kind of sharp observations on the city and some of the people who live there.
I would second that. I mean, I liked this, and I think that there are lots of people who would, but I think you know who you are. If a book about an unlikable, depressed person who wants to sleep for a year and treats her friends badly and takes a lot of drugs, I think you know if that sounds like it's up your alley or not.
Yeah.
Okay, what are we doing next?
Next, we are venturing into something I would not necessarily say happier, but we are taking a different tack. We're ending our run of darkness. We're ending our run of darkness. And we are doing The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna.
This is a book that I have seen on lots of bookshelves. It's a book that I have seen in the front of Barnes & Noble over and over again. It's a book that I've not really seen in used bookshops. People don't seem to be getting rid of this one.
No,
quite popular. It's
people
not
hang on to this book.
I got three used bookshops around me, and it's not a single one of them.
This is a book that people pass on to others. I'm fairly certain that my mother read this book and passed it on to me, and that I was either instructed to pass it on to someone else or that I just chose to pass it on.
Well, shit, that was who I was going to hit up for a copy. So
She gave it to me, and I'm fairly certain that I was instructed to either give it to someone else, or I might have just enjoyed it to the point that it was like, this should go to someone else. It is a historical fiction novel that takes place in World War II. So while I would not necessarily say that it is a happier book,
World War II, nobody ever makes media about that.
I love World War II historical fiction.
Apparently everybody loves World War II.
Everybody does. And that's a nice, and we will kick off
it's like the
next podcast.
It's like the only thing everyone agrees on is that the only reference you can have is, or you should have, is for something about World War II.
People like sad, pretty girls in books about World War II.
Yeah. All right. All right. Looking forward to it. It's not something I would probably pick on my own, so this will be fun.
I think I'm looking forward to talking about it.
All right. So as always, you can write us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at readingpopclassics or on Lit Salon at readingpopclassics. And we will see you next time.
And thanks for listening.